alcoholic. Sobriety date's May 5th, 1987. I live in Buckingham County, which is out in the country. It's probably about like Madison. We have small groups out there. So when somebody said tonight won't be a big group, this is a big group to me because I go to meetings in Dillon. If I want big meetings, I have to go to Charlottesville or Richmond or Chesterfield or D.C., which I have been in some big meetings. But what I attend every week is small meetings, anywhere from 5 to 15 people. And if we have 20 on one night, we're pushing it. And if we have 20 on one night, the next night it will not be 20. One time I was worried that we had started a Thursday night speakers meeting and it was growing very quickly. Within about 6 months, we were full almost to the wall. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to have to move churches. And I started to ponder on that and think about that and wonder if we have to move, where are we going to get the church? And then alcoholism took care of that. The crowd diminished. Alcoholism keeps us in the same churches for years. And Billy's got 20 years, boy. That's a milestone. Mm-hmm. I think I've known Billy almost my whole sobriety. Maybe there's a few years not. He's kept me on my toes the whole time. And we have changed together. And, if you stay around here long enough, AA will change you. At least that's its intention, and that's been my experience. I like to start out that I'm not a voice for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a spokesman. I come here and I share what my experience is. If it contradicts you or clashes with you, I'm not in any argument or any conflict with you whatsoever. In fact, the more I can avoid conflict, the better my life is. I grew up in Calvert County, Maryland, on the Chesapeake Bay with a house overlooking the bay every morning. There's alcohol in my home. There's alcoholism in my home. There's alcoholism down the street. I lived in a drinking community, and I grew up with it and saw it every day in somebody's hand, all day long. Usually Budweiser beer or Scotch on the Rocks. I remember those being very popular growing up. I saw people fall down. I saw people get in fights. I saw all of it. And I remember saying to myself, and I don't know how old I was at that time, that I'm not going to be like that because I'm not going to drink. That's awful from what I saw. Of course, that did not come true. As I grew up, when I look back, I was a very self-centered, very afraid person. You know, I wouldn't have known that till I got here to AA. You know, I was able to put my thumb on a lot of things because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I would have never been able to put my thumb on if I hadn't come here. And I think as a kid, I was dominated by fear, really. And I got sent to a psychologist when I was 16 years old. I had dabbled in the drug environment and had been drinking on and off. The psychologist had diagnosed me with depression, anxiety. How I know that is when I was cleaning out my mother's house after she'd passed on, my father had kept it in a file. And that's how I know. I got to open it up and look at what the guy was saying. So he lacked self-confidence, self-esteem, all these kind of things. And I was getting worse, not better. I was a high school dropout. I thought that was cool. My father had other intentions for me, so I got sent off. I got some intensive therapy for a while. Well-meaning people. Good people. I think they meant the best for me. And I walked away with two ideas. One that I had an emotional illness that could be overcome through self-esteem, self-confidence, and personal relationships. And that the center of my problems was personal relationships. Of course, in AA, I would bump back into that idea. And so After completion of this intensive therapy for quite a long time, it was a boarding school, it was about 18 months of it, I got a GED and I went to college. And I was 1 year ahead of the people that I would have gone to high school with. And so I gave myself a pat on the back and I started drinking. And within 6 months, I had two drunk driving charges. And what I found out when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took time to make sense, that I didn't suffer from an emotional problem. It felt like one, it looked like one, and it carried the symptoms of an emotional problem. But I would suffer from what AA would expose me to as a spiritual problem that would have the same symptoms and the same emotions that the emotional problem without the spiritual would have. And as I get into that, I'll share why that's so important to me. Because the good people that had diagnosed me with the low self-esteem and the lack of self-confidence and deference, I was able to establish self-esteem and self-confidence. I had a belief in God, but I didn't have a personal relationship with God until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and took the steps. So I was able to grab a hold of these things, but I couldn't stay sober. When 1978 came, my life changed. I had already kind of grown up in the pre-hippie era, and I really, for some reason, I wanted to be a hippie. It just really appealed to me. There's a part in the big book in the early chapters, and I believe it's We Agnostics, and I believe it's more about alcoholism, and it has a little idea in there that says, what was he thinking? And that's kind of the story of my drink. What was he thinking? So in 1978, there's a significant change in my life. One is I saw the movie Cheech and Chong Up in Smoke. And that really was interesting to me because when I saw that, I really felt at home. That was something I was becoming, and I really liked it. And the other thing that happened to me is that when I was in college, my friend gave me two hits of, we call it blotter, but it's LSD, post-LSD. Washed it down with a 12-pack of Heineken, and somebody turned me on to Jerry Garcia's guitar, and it was an absolutely unbelievable spiritual experience for me. And I became a deadhead, the traveling gypsies. Before it was popular, before anybody knew about it or heard about it, we were deadheads. And that was a significant change in my life, and it led to debauchery. I mean, just the amount of drugs and alcohol we consumed on those tours is unbelievable. What was he thinking? My God, what was he thinking? And as most of us know, that we're in the grips of a progressive illness, it always gets worse, it doesn't get better. And that when I look back at the drinking, though, you can't see it while you're into it. I can see the progression of this illness. As the years turned from 78 to 79 to 80 to 81, things were getting worse. Not overnight, but in a slow manner for me. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd been arrested 11 times, fingerprinted and put in a cage. And you know what? It just, those things didn't dawn on me. That was part of it. You know, I just, nowadays, I'd be very embarrassed. I'd be shocked. You got to back then, okay, I'm going to get out. I'll get out on bond, you know, whatever. That alcoholism had a hold on me, you know, a big hold on me. And I like what the conclusion that the book comes to, because the book always remains smarter than I, because God created it in his genius. This book is fabulous. It says in the book that it would be academic and pointless. You know, if I just had a problem of a physical allergy, that I just had a drinking, and when I drank, I got drunk, then just overcome it. Stop drinking. But it says the real problem for a guy like me centers in my mind, not in my body. that I got a problem up here. Okay. And it's a bigger problem than I realize. And that's the power, one of the powers of this illness of Alcoholics Anonymous is you don't realize the insanity of it until you step out of it and look back into it. Okay? Business as usual. Yeah. Got drunk last night, fell on the floor, couldn't get up. Business as usual. What was he thinking? A lot of times when I got drunk and really fell off the table or fell out of the window or punched the hole in the wall or whatever I did, it was at a, if you were with a crowd of people and you passed out the next day, it was like, God, that was cool. Did you see what happened to you last night? I mean, you're laughing about things that nowadays you wouldn't laugh at. And then I started to have, as the years went on and probably flipping up to about 1985, I had to come off a tour with the Grateful Dead because I was burned out. Nothing was working. This wasn't wired right. And the hangovers were becoming tremendous for me. The hangovers were just brutal doesn't describe it. Okay, and I got a friend that we get along really well. He said he never had hangovers when he was drinking. Okay, I did. and so I would go to the bar and try to find out, well, how do you not have these severe hangovers the next day that keep you in bed? You throw up, you puke, you know, you got to eat food, throw back up, you're dehydrated, drums beating in your head all day long, called a headache. You know, you swear it off, and that night you're drinking again in the bar, but you have to find out, how do I overcome a... So the first thing that I heard was, drink a lot of water. So I would drink a lot of water before I started drinking. And I would drink water before I went to bed, if I didn't pass out first or get locked up. It didn't solve the problem. I still had a hangover. So then I went to my deadhead friends one day, and we were talking about how to come over hangover. We were smoking Toke Masters and U.S. bongs back there. That's a long time ago. And so, smoke a bong hit in the morning. And so what I would do is I would smoke a bong hit first thing in the morning, and I would just go off. Ooh, I mean, it's a good high. You're no earthly good to anybody. The whole day was spoiled because you would be intoxicated on marijuana and then, of course, alcohol again. Next thing that I heard when I talked to somebody was eat a lot of food, drink a lot of water. So I ate a lot of food, I drank a lot of water, and I still had the hangover. And then the last thing in the treasure chest of the hangover from the folks in the bar that I associated with. And it took me a while to get there because I didn't want to get there overnight, but I kept it in the back of the piggy bank here. Wake up and drink alcohol. That will overcome the hangover. Okay? That overcame the hangover, I'm here to tell you. Okay? Wake up in the morning, being sick from the alcohol, and start drinking. Okay? If you start drinking in the morning like I did, you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your relationships, you're going to lose your bank account, you're going to lose everything. But it does start to take care of the hangover, okay? Is you drink till you pass out, and when you wake up, you drink again. And then I remember something happened that was part of this sickness called alcoholism. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Barfly with Mickey Rourke, but he talks about drinking for energy. And I would be zapped out from the hangover, from the merit. Well, I didn't have that after a while. Last 2 years before AA, I was pretty much just a straight drinker. There wasn't drugs anymore. And I would I just drank myself into oblivion. I'd get up, drink again, and I lost everything. I took care of the hangover, but it was a sad day, and that went on for till I lost just about everything. That's the shape I was in when I got here, and it was Alcohol did me really well. It put me right in my seat of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do think that it's a pretty sick idea that you start drinking for energy so you can get to the bar and drink more, because you know if you get alcohol in you, you get enough energy to get to that bar. And I came into AA with that train of thought. I had no intentions of staying here. I'd been here before. I'd been sent by the courts. I'd been sent by me because I was in some hardships. One time I stayed here for 10 years because, for 10 months, excuse me, because I had flunked out of college for the second time. I was living in an abandoned house on food stamps in a one room with no running water. And I decided I'd go to AA, and I went to AA for 10 months. And in that 10 months, I got a job. I got off the food stamps, had a little money in the bank, was able to afford a car. And then I went to I'll always remember this. I was in Georgetown, Washington that night. And I said, I'm going to have a drink. And I did. And for the next 5 years, I just told you what happened in that progression of alcoholism. What was he thinking? So I came here, and I heard what you said. You said, you know, you got to plug into the meetings. I plugged into the meetings. The steps weren't out there like they are today. Okay? 12 and 12s were there. Okay? The big book was given out. It really wasn't talked about a lot. But I had a 12 and 12. I had a 24-hour-a-day book. And I had a big book. And I was going to a meeting about every night. And I was working about 17 hours a day to save my job. And I was here about 18 months. I was sober. Something was lacking or missing. I'd taken the steps off the wall, and I had an off-the-wall program. Didn't know that at the time. And somebody introduced me to Joe and Charlie from Arkansas, and I went up to Containing, Pennsylvania. I have the book at my house that they signed, so I know what the date is. 12/16/1989. And that night was a tremendous snowstorm, and so Joe and Charlie couldn't get in from Pittsburgh. So they met down at this church, and we were sitting in this room about this big with tables, and these people had these big books and they were highlighted. I'd never seen anything like it. And they talked about the steps out of the big book and how to change their life. I'd never done that because the big book to me was kind of like a sedative. I'd read the stories and fall asleep. I'd crack open Bill's story or something and think, ah, that's a little outdated. I didn't even get the gist of what the book Alcoholics Anonymous was. I had no idea. And so the next day, Joe and Charlie came in, and my life changed forever. It's never been the same. All the myths that I had created off the wall and what I had heard from here and there and put together were all broken within a weekend. And I spent the next years becoming a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous with a bunch of fanatics. And I started to see the myths of the steps that were related, that it wasn't a clear message. That we had a message here. It was the spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And there was a way to get there from point A to point B. There was a set of directions. And that in the first step, what I had heard in the meetings and what I had pulled off the wall was we were powerless over people, places, and things that didn't belong in the first step. They may belong somewhere else in another conversation in recovery, but it didn't belong in the first step. I'm cross-addicted, did not belong in the first step. I'm powerless over my addictions, did not belong in the first step. It says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. And the doctor's opinion backed that up with the idea of a physical allergy of the body and a mental obsession in my brain. And then for the first time, I knew why the first drink got me drunk. I didn't know that. I believed it, but I didn't know it because I didn't have the information that would back that up. Not everybody in AA is a concrete thinker. I need it concrete. I need it explained. I can put it in. I can't. If it's ambiguous, it goes all over the place. So I had an obsession of the mind. I had a physical allergy of the body. It made me powerless over alcohol. I can stop drinking on my own. I can't stay stopped. I can see that. And once I start drinking, I lose control of my consumption of alcohol. I can see that. So I ask myself, am I really an alcoholic? Yes. Well, if you're an alcoholic with an obsession and a physical allergy and you drink yourself into oblivion, your life's going to be unmanageable. It's a no-brainer. Okay? If you drink like an alcoholic drinks, you're going to have an unmanageable life. There's no way around it. Look at it. Okay, I held a job. So what? Doesn't mean my whole life wasn't unmanageable. Step two, I'm crazy. I came out of the nut house. I have a psychiatric disorder. It has nothing to do with step two. When I came out of the Joe and Charlie conference, and I will back it up. I saw him 13 times after that. I became friends with him. Joe McQueenie became one of our mentors. All of those myths started to be broken. That the second step wasn't a diagnosis of a psychiatric illness. It was a diagnosis of an alcoholic illness, with the solution being spiritual. And the early part of the book, the solution being spiritual, is called a spiritual experience, before later on they were smart enough to turn into a spiritual awakening, so it opened the doors up. So what do I suffer from in step two? The insanity of the first drink, that I drink again if my mind does not find, or what the doctor calls in the doctor's opinion, which is an intellectual way of explaining what a spiritual experience is. He called it a psychic change. He said, I can't overcome this because the emotional barometer of irritable, restless, and discontent, if I don't have a relief from that, I drink again. And I repeat this over and over and over with a firm resolution, and I break that. This thing started making sense to me all of a sudden. I had a friend of me told me that he took 16 years to find faith in the second step. That's not in ours. I'm not going to take it from his experience, but I... Second step is one short question. Am I willing to believe, or do I now believe, that a power greater than myself... You know, upon this, we can build this effective spiritual structure in our life. We don't have to comprehend or understand this power. We just need to be willing to believe. The insanity of my situation isn't the thing that carries me into the psychiatric ward. It's me picking up another drink despite the consequences in my life. The best example I have of that, when we were doing the penitentiary meetings, the guy had spent 10 years in the Buckingham Penitentiary, which is the maximum penitentiary. We've got a minimum and a maximum. Buckingham is the maximum. He spent 10 years in there. They let him out. He got on a bus to Atlanta, Georgia. And when the bus stopped to get gas, he went out and got the alcohol. He got so drunk on the bus that he violated his parole and they put him back in the penitentiary. We were talking to him after they put him back in. That's the insanity that we're talking about. You can't understand it intellectually just because you heard it. You got to have the experience of the steps and the fellowship to get that thing ingrained where you get plugged in here. Where, and one of the promises here is that the obsession to drink is removed. We are restored to sanity. That means that there's nothing that can get us drunk. I hear people say, the woman got me drunk. She didn't get you drunk. The job got me drunk. Unhappiness got me drunk. I changed states, got me drunk. No. The only thing that ever got me drunk was alcohol. And when you're restored to sanity, you see the truth about the first drink. If you're not, then you're wide open. If you're an alcoholic of my type, you'll drink again. I was very confused about step three. I've heard so many different different things about it. We made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understood. There's some powerful information from page 60 to page 63. There's powerful information in there. It still excites me today when I read it. Having that knowledge, we make a third step. We take the first third step prayer. And then we follow the decision with steps 4 through 9, the things that are blocking us. And the things that are blocking us, we start to cast aside through steps 4 through 9. So the third step decision is a prayer followed through 4 through 9. Didn't get it till I got that. What happened is it started to become simple. Then I wrote an inventory. I wrote an inventory off the wall. It didn't look like anything like from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And what fascinates me, and I've been in a lot of this lately, this is why this is coming out, is the third column of the fourth step. I never knew it was in there. It's where all human problems are created, and it's where society is created at the same time. It talks about these instincts in collision later on in the 12 and 12. Bill kind of explained a little bit better. That's sex, security, and social, which I call romance, finance, and self-importance. Okay. I've not had a problem. They've done a number on me in sobriety. Okay. Romance, finance, and self-importance has done a number on me. Okay. But you got to understand the third column to build the fourth column. And I think one of the most phenomenal things that really leads to the basis of my recovery today is that this thing is so on, it blows me away. It says, aren't most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity? Yeah. The alcoholic, our problems arise out of ourselves. Yeah. I thought they arised out here. Okay, because I'm threatened. Romance, finance, self-importance. I'm threatened. That's where fear comes from. I'm threatened. It's where my resentments have come from. And gosh, oh my gosh. So I'm not going to go through each thing. I'm going to end with this idea. Is that this was not a process anymore of me working on myself. That was a psychological process. This is a process of the Father doeth the work through the process of the steps and the fellowship that I allow God to intervene in my thinking and my life, and it's very slow. Okay, I like what my sponsor says. He calls this slow-briety. That might be an understatement, okay, because I've moved very slow in this. I'm glad I have the information. And one of the things that I came out of, too, that I no longer say, and again, if other people say it's fine, I still hear it in meetings all the time, it's part of the AA lingo, is that I have to get out of the driver's seat. I don't have to get out of the driver's seat. I have to follow a different set of directions. It doesn't matter what seat I sit in. God gave me self-will for a reason. My problem was I was following a set of directions called a self-determined objective. That was my problem. Still is my problem today. So these steps started making sense to me. They were no longer ambiguous. They were no longer pulled off of this speaker or pulled out of this meeting or put together in a conglomeration. And they weren't cafeteria style anymore. Take what you want, leave the rest. All of those things were smashed. I had a lot of money to pay back, financial amends. I owed about $28,000 of bad debt. Just not very good when I got here. Took me 13 years to pay it back. I paid every cent of it back. Got free of it. At 13 years, somewhere in there, I started a business. I looked at Pockets of Enthusiasm. Somebody sent me a picture of that. It was probably 1995, and Johnny Harris was there, and Clancy was there, and Nancy was in it. Ray O'Keefe was in it. Dick Martin was in it. I had another one with Ray, Johnny, and Clancy. And I looked at that picture because we started Pockets of Enthusiasm in Virginia Beach. I believe the first one was 1994, I think, a long time ago. I looked at that picture and I fell in love with it. These were some of my mentors in Alcoholics Anonymous, people that inspired my life and changed my life with who they were. The tough thing was when and this was the hardest thing for me. I went through, I don't know how long it lasted, but it was very difficult. I found out they had character defects one day, and that was just a bummer. I mean, these guys were larger than life, you know. And I just felt like I sat on the shoulders of giants for a long time. Joe and Charlie and Johnny and Clancy and Ray, and there's a string of them. And then they all had character defects. I was like, what for? You know? And I looked at that picture, and I said to myself, that was a long time ago. I was a completely different person, almost in a completely different age. You know? Life has changed so much, it's not even... I couldn't even describe it in the time that you are going to give me up here. I just couldn't describe how much this program with life changes us. And so I had all these things going. I was married. I had the business. The business, you know, took a couple of years to get off. Started to do very well. And I learned an important lesson later on in life. It may not apply to you. You may be very happy in it. Don't have business partners. I realized lately in an inventory that I did that I used to say that we got along really well for a long time, and then the last 4 years it kind of fell apart. That's not true. I ignored it for a long time. The problems were always there. And I start to look at one of my character defects that show up probably in fear somewhere is I ignore things because I think they're going to get better or go away. And most of them don't get better and they don't go away. I would probably do better if I faced it headlong on and just said, hey, look, this isn't working. Let's come up and whatever. There's another saying that I really like. My brother came to visit with, I think it's his wife, but it could be his girlfriend. She says she's Mrs. Jacobson, but they've never gotten married, so I don't know. I love my brother, and she's a good person too. But there's an old saying, short visits, long friendships. There's a lot of truth in that one, you know. I miss my brother when I go, but 3 days were short visits, long friendships. Unfortunately, you can't do that when you get married. It becomes a little bit more tedious. So, you know, things are really going good. I got a great 9-step story. The guys that almost fired me when I'm drinking, I'm a business partner with them. You know, money's not a problem. I just look at everything, and everything was kind of ticking. Bought property, built a big old house in Buckingham. I wish I could move it to Albemarle. I wish I could take that house and put it in Albemarle. I'd be in really, really good shape financially. But I can't get it moved. It's in Buckingham. We're the poor county. So I built a big old house. I call it, I built my ego. As you get older, you'd rather downsize all the stuff I want to get rid of now. When I was younger, I wanted to have it all. As I get older, I want to get rid of it all. My wife asked me the other day, she said, what would you like to do in the future? I said, that's real simple. I want to be a nomad. She said, what do you mean? I said, I want to buy a F-350 and put a camper on the back, and I want to travel and live in Walmarts and rest stops for about 2 years while I bicycle across the United States and hit every meeting I can on a daily basis. From here to California, maybe up into Canada. She goes, oh, really? She said, you would sell all this? I said, in a minute. I'm a little goofy the older I stay sober. You know, I remember sharing with my first sponsor when I was about 7 years sober. I've been enlightened by the steps, like I told you. They made sense to me now. I knew how to read the big book. I saw the set of directions. They're right up in my face. They're very simple. I've got that part of it. But I'm still a little screwed up. And I called my sponsor. I said, you know, I think I'm really screwed up. And he goes, when you accept that, you'll be a lot happier. Probably a lot of truth in that one. So, when I was, years were good in there. Like I said, I think I avoided a lot of stuff that was sitting in my face, but I could avoid it because I could avoid it until it came right up in my face. And when it came up in my face, it caused probably, I'd say off and on, probably about 5 years of resentments, partnerships, and everything else. My wife got drunk after a period of time here, and I don't wish that upon anybody. It's not a very good situation for either people. If you haven't been in it, I can say right now you don't fully understand it. Because I used to listen to other people, I thought I understood it. You don't understand it until you live with it. The only way you can understand that if you lived in a house and somebody started drinking again, it'll make you crazy. And it made me crazy. You know, some of the ways I acted and reacted, I'm glad that none of you know about that. My sponsor does. And I don't feel real good about it, but it's just the way it was. I wasn't acting like a person should be at 25 years of sobriety. I'll assure you that. But we dust off our britches here and we get back up and we walk forward. That's what we do. And the business went south, everything, the financial situation. I got hit in the third column really, really, really hard. I got hit in romance, I got hit in finance, and I got hit in self-importance. I got hit on all levels. I woke up every day just scared. And what I found out for me, with the knowledge of the steps and knowing what I know about the book and loving the book Alcoholics Anonymous and this process of the steps, this stuff is not easy. In the fourth step, there's a line there that says that we disregard the other person entirely. Where were we wrong? That's not easy. Okay. In the eighth step, in the 12 and 12, it says the first obstacle we have to do is we have to overcome this. We got to find forgiveness. It's not easy, always. Okay. I've hit a lot of obstacles, mostly within myself, but very difficult. Very difficult. When I was 10 years sober, I thought 3 and 4 meetings a week were enough. When I was 15 years sober, I thought 5 or 6 meetings were enough. 4 or 5 meetings were enough. When I hit 25 years sober, I found out that 7 meetings a week for me is enough. And I have fallen in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will not let anything get in the way of meetings, what's ever going on in my life. I've often said it that if you have 2 tickets to paradise, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place, and you describe it, and everybody wants to go. If you're not there and you don't meet on a daily basis, I'm not going. If you would like to go, I've got no problem with it. Please go. I'm not going. I'm not going anywhere in the world where there isn't a meeting on a daily basis, whether I make it or not. It's just too important to me. And when I talk about meetings and what happened to me, that there was an evolution and change in that. The first thing is 90 meetings in 90 days, and we go to meetings because we need to go to meetings. We go to meetings because we want to go to meetings. We have a lot of different things around the meetings that help us to stay motivated. Go to a meeting when you don't feel like going to a meeting, you know, whatever. But what happened to me with meetings, something happened over a period of time, is they stopped just becoming a place that I went, they started becoming service. Everything changed. When they were just a place I went because I needed to go, and sometimes I got a boost and sometimes I didn't, that's different. when I was really going through my Joe and Charlie phase of the book and all that, I probably alienated a lot of people because I didn't know how to say what I wanted to say without alienating people, so I hit them over the head with the book. You find out that doesn't work, okay? And you fall into this stage that I call judgmentalism, okay? That this meeting doesn't do it right. This guy here irritates me. She irritates me. Don't go to that meeting. They don't talk enough about God. They talk too much about God. They smoke in the front door. They don't smoke in that meeting. You know, on and on and on, have the list. There's a point in recovery when you turn the meetings into service and you're not there to straighten them out and they're not there to have a purpose for you. All meetings serve the same purpose. And you start to like every meeting you go to. And you don't walk out of one and say, oh my God, I wish I didn't go. Those people don't know what they're talking about. That's ego. I think people leave Alcoholics Anonymous. One reason is because they get judgmental here and they leave. I got a friend in Buckingham that he told me why he left Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, he was only making one meeting a week. I don't know about his sponsor or steps. I know a lot of people in Buckingham. I've been there for a long time in the AA community. And he said he quit because on Sunday night they read too much. They used to read seven things. If you don't like a meeting that reads too much, you can go to meetings that don't. There's ways around that. Okay. The other threat to the meetings is what I call a case of the busies. Okay. I get sober and all of a sudden, I got an income. Job's going pretty good. Girlfriend, boyfriend, maybe even a kid. You know, I'm busy. And I don't know about you, but I used to be really, really afraid when I first came to AA that I would be bored. Oh my God, there's a vacuum here. I spent every night of my life in a bar or on the floor or out in the lawn or whatever, hangover. What? I had the B's wrong. It's not bored, it's busy. And for most of us, I'm not going to say everybody, we're pretty high energy people. Okay? When we get into something, we get into it. Might get into the job, might get into whatever, making money. I've seen a lot of people do that. And all of a sudden, they're not showing up anymore. They got a case of the busies. You can have a case of the busies and still show up here. If you want to. If you don't, there's a bulletproof excuse. We won't argue with you. I've heard them all. I needed to get my job going. I needed to make money. I needed to raise my kids. These are all important things. We're not poo-pooing. They're all important. But what AA has always said very loud, very clear, that a slip is sobriety losing its priority. Okay? The last thing a person does when they relapse is drink. The first thing, they have mental slips. It starts with getting away from this. And once I start getting away from Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no proof that I'm not starting to get away from all of it. Okay? If I haven't been to a meeting in 6 months, how am I doing the steps? How am I in touch with a sponsor? For me, and again, I'm not a voice of Alcoholics Anonymous. You may have an entirely different experience, but I've become aware of my thinking over the years. It's disturbed sometimes. But if I go 2 days without a meeting, which is very, very, very rare, it starts getting a little bit more negative up here. It starts getting a little bit more agitated. Doesn't feel right. When I go to meetings on a regular basis, which I do, I try to make a meeting on a daily basis if I can. This thinks better. It thinks better. And that's what I've needed. I need that tune-up on a daily basis. I'm not saying everybody here needs that. I have no idea. I have another friend in Alcoholics Anonymous at 13 years. He quit. He said he doesn't get anything out of this anymore. Now, I love him like a grandfather. I almost said, how can you quit something you've never been in? But I did not say that. And I still talk to him on a weekly basis. He's one of my good friends. He taught me a lot about business after my business. He's a great business guy. I don't think he's been to one meeting in the last 13 years. I don't think he's going to drink again. He's 81 years old. He told me the one thing he took out of Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, I'm not going to drink. I believe him. I'd be shocked if he did. But I'll tell you a story, though, to go along with that. Something happens when I get away from this fellowship, these steps, and all this kind of stuff. Something happens. One thing that we call here, we call it emotionally unsober. Okay? Another phrase that I used to use and like is undrunk. Bill Wilson likes the phrase dry bender. Okay? I've been on all those being in AA. Okay? I'm a champion of dry benders. That's what Bill said me to. Okay? So one day I was visiting his wife and she says, I need to share something with you. I said, fine. She said, you know when he was out in his garden? And his garden's in the backyard. I said, yeah, I said he spends every day. She said, well, this was last year. He had a heart attack. And he was out there and he called in on the cell phone to me. And I picked up the cell phone. And he said, can you call the emergency squad right now? I think I'm having a heart attack. And she said, what I feel most guilty about, after I hung up the phone, I put it down. And I thought about not calling them. Now that's without a drink. But there's no spiritual solution, okay? That's like the bus of the guy that got out 10 years. That's one of my famous stories. Okay? So you can stay physically sober here, and I believe that a lot of people, not everybody that leaves AA and doesn't come back gets drunk. There's at least five in Dillwyn that have been out there for a long time and they haven't drank. I haven't talked to their wives, but they haven't drank. Okay. So later on, what Bill wrote, Billy, do you have the time? Oh, thank you. He wrote an article in the Grapevine in 1958 called Emotional Sobriety, the Final Frontier. And what he talked about, that he had all these false dependencies on what people thought or hear. You know, he had these dependencies, and the real dependency needed to come to God. And I've been striving in that direction my whole sobriety. I haven't totally got there yet. Okay. On some days, I'm not emotionally sober. And other days, I am. Some days, I'm full of fear. Some days, I'm not. Some days I have wicked resentments. I can drum them up pretty quick. I've got a whole list of them. And I know better than being a victim. But I've learned one thing. Just because I know better doesn't mean I always do better. One of the beautiful gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous is we just do the very best we can on a daily basis. And with God's help and your help in these steps, we get to do just a little bit better in our life also. Just a little bit better. And sometimes that's all I'm required here to do is just a little bit better. And what's happened to me is God has meant so much more to me as time has gone on in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, I started with a belief. I had a belief prior to AA, couldn't get out of the county jail. AA showed me how to have a personal relationship. And what I found about God here that really opened the doors up for me, it was a God that I didn't need to be afraid of. It was a God that was user-friendly. I have another friend down in Florida, he calls me. He's very, very intelligent, far more than me. He was a lawyer, everything else. And he said that what he learned And he was going, talking to me about this, and he wasn't asking me, he was talking to me, and he was telling me that he was involved in this intensive 11-step with these people, and that they had really brought up the idea that if you think it, you become it, and you have to change your thinking and all this kind of stuff, and that the closer that you would get to God, the more things that would happen in your life that you didn't like. And he was going on, and he stopped in his conversation after he talked to me for 10 minutes on it. That was a bit much to take, but I did listen. And he asked me, he said, "What do you think about it?" And I said, "Well, we all have a different conception here. That's the beautiful thing of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can have that conception. I'd be in no conflict with it. I don't have that." I said, Bill finally came out in the second tradition. He said, a loving God that will express himself in our group conscience. A loving God. Okay? So here is the challenge. Do I create my problems through my thinking process? Okay? And then it happens, kind of like karma. You can believe that. If that was true, I wouldn't be standing up here tonight. Okay. For me. If we go back in our book, it says, who created our problems? It says us. We made a decision based on self that put us in that position. Okay. I look at the financial trouble I had with the partnerships. I made a decision based on self. I didn't think through it. I ignored it. I look at each area of my life that has made me uncomfortable or unhappy, or I'm in a position I don't like, and I ask myself, how did I make a decision based on self that put me in that position? And I always come up with it. I had a person come to the house. We had a leaky floor. It ruined my kitchen. I knew it was going to cost a bunch of money. In fact, it ended up $34,000 of a dishwasher leaking for probably 6 months to a year. Under the floor so you couldn't see it till it came up in mold. Okay? I had a person come and say, you thought yourself into that. I said, no, I never thought about my kitchen leaking. They said, you brought it on through your thinking process. I said, no, let's look at this. How did I make a decision based on self? Okay? I bought a new dishwasher a year prior to that. The guy that installed it that morning was angry towards his boss for making him work on Saturday and not paying him enough, and he pushed it in and he did something underneath. My first inclination, my intuitive thought was, call his boss, I know him really well, and let him know this guy didn't do it. He shoved it in, I let it go. I turned it on and it worked. And I said, well, I'm going to let bygones be. There I go again. I ignored it. Okay. So I made a decision based on self rather than calling the boss and saying, can you come over here and look at it? This guy didn't have a good attitude. I don't know if he put it in right or not. I just let it go. Again, I found myself making that decision based on self. And I can do that in every aspect of my life. How did I get in that position that I don't like? Okay. All righty. So I'm going to close up here. We're running out of time. I'm glad that you introduced me to the God that I can live with today. That's part of my life on a daily basis. Like I said, it's user-friendly. There's no complications except for me. God's not trying to test my faith or teach me a lesson. And God has been so kind to us, he gave us this gift. And God could have given this gift to our friends in the medical community, but he didn't. The doctor's opinion is absolutely fantastic, and AA will love Silkworth the rest of our life. But he didn't give the message there. He could have given it to our friends in the psychological department, but he didn't. But he allowed us to they gave us the basis of step two with Carl Jung talking to Roland Hazard in 1931. We got the basis of that out of the psychological department. He could have given it to our friends in the religious department, good friends that have always supported us. But he didn't. But we look at the Oxford group, and they gave a significant contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of steps 3 through 12, and a lot of different things were borrowed or stolen or plagiarized from the Oxford group. But he didn't give the message there. He gave the message to a broke-down stock speculator named Bill Wilson and a washed-up proctologist named Dr. Bob. The beautiful thing of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you read into the history, is that these two people had absolutely nothing in common. They were on two ends of a spectrum, two opposite poles, and they had complete chemistry among them. And their foundation was built not on knowledge, but on the fact that they are one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And Dr. Bob reminds us, in simple terms, let's not louse this thing up with Freudian concepts and things that are interesting to the scientific mind. Let's keep this thing simple. And that's where we find God, is in simplicity.